Sato said thoughtfully. Is he the man the boy spoke of as his teacher?
That's right. From the way he's been trying to develop a piece of wasted land on Hotengahara, the villagers thought he was a little soft in the head.
I'd like to meet him, said Sato, but then he remembered the work waiting for him in Edo.
Never mind. I'll talk to him the next time I come out here.
He turned his horse around and left the peasant standing by the road. A few minutes later, he reined up in front of the village headman's gate. There, written in shiny ink on a fresh board, hung a sign, "Reminder for the people of the village. Your plow is your sword. Your sword is your plow. Working in the fields, don't forget the invasion. Thinking of the invasion, don't forget your fields. All things must be balanced and integrated. Most important, do not oppose the way of successive generations."
Who wrote this?
The headman had finally come out and was now bowing on the ground before Sado.
"Musashi," he answered.
Turning to the priest, Sado said,
"Thank you for bringing us here. It's too bad I couldn't meet this Musashi, but just now I don't have the time. I'll be back this way before long."
First Planting. The management of the palatial Hosokawa residence in Edo, as well as the performance of the fief's duties to the shogun, was entrusted to a man still in his early 20s, Tadatoshi, the eldest son of the daimyo Hosokawa Tadaoki. The father, a celebrated general who also enjoyed a reputation as a poet and master of the tea ceremony, preferred to live at the large Kokura fief in Buzen province on the island of Kyushu. Though Nagaoka Sado and a number of other trusted retainers were assigned to assist the young man, this was not because he was in any way incompetent. He was not only accepted as a peer by the powerful vassals closest to the shogun, but had distinguished himself as an energetic and far-sighted administrator. In fact, he seemed more in tune with the peace and prosperity of the times than the older lords who had been nurtured on constant warfare. At the moment, Sado was walking in the general direction of the riding ground.
"Have you seen the young lord?"
he asked of an apprentice samurai coming toward him.
"I believe he's at the archery range."
As Sado threaded his way down a narrow path, he heard a voice asking,
"May I have a word with you?"
Sado stopped, and Iwama Kakubei, a vassal respected for his shrewdness and practicality, came up to him.
"You're going to talk with his lordship?" he asked.
"Yes."
"If you're not in a hurry, there's a little matter I'd like to consult with you about. Why don't we sit down over there?"
As they walked a few steps to a rustic arbor, Kakubei said,
"I have a favor to ask. If you have a chance during your talk, there's a man I'd like to recommend to the young lord."
"Someone wanting to serve the house of Hosokawa?"
"Yes, I know all sorts of people come to you with the same request, but this man's very unusual."
"Is he one of those men interested only in security and a stipend?"
"Definitely not. He's related to my wife. He's been living with us since he came up from Iwakuni a couple of years ago, so I know him quite well."
"Iwakuni? The house of Kikawa held Suo province before the Battle of Sekigahara. Is he one of their ronin?"
"No, he's the son of a rural samurai. His name's Sasaki Kojiro. He's still young, but he was trained in the Tomita style of Kanemaki Jisai, and he learned the techniques of drawing a sword with lightning swiftness from Lord Katayama Hisayasu of Hoki. He's even created a style of his own, which he calls Ganryu."
Kakubei went on, listing in detail Kojiro's various exploits and accomplishments. Sado was not really listening. His mind had gone back to his last visit to the Tokuganji. Though he was sure, even from the little he'd seen and heard, that Musashi was the right sort of man for the house of Hosokawa, he had intended to meet him personally before recommending him to his master. In the meantime, A year and a half had slipped by without his finding an opportunity to visit Hotengahara. When Kakube finished, Sado said, "I'll do what I can for you," and continued on to the archery range. Tadatoshi was engaged in a contest with some vassals of his own age, none of whom was remotely a match for him. His shots, unerringly on target, were executed with flawless style. A number of retainers had chided him for taking archery so seriously, arguing that in an age of gun and lance, neither sword nor bow was any longer of much use in actual combat. To this he had replied cryptically, "My arrows are aimed at the spirit." The Hosokawa retainers had the highest respect for Tadatoshi, and would have served under him with enthusiasm even if his father, to whom they were also devoted, had not been a man of substantial accomplishments. At the moment, Sado regretted the promise he'd just made to Kakube. Tadatoshi was not a man to whom one lightly recommended prospective retainers. Wiping the sweat off his face, Tadatoshi walked past several young samurai with whom he'd been talking and laughing. Catching a sight of Sado, he called, "How about it, ancient one? Have a shot?"
"I make it a rule to compete only against adults," Sado replied. "So you still think of us little boys with our hair tied up on our heads? Have you forgotten the Battle of Yamazaki? Nirayama Castle? I have been commanded for my performance on the battlefield, you know. Besides, I go in for real archery, not..."
"Ha ha! Sorry I mentioned it. I didn't mean to get you started again." The others joined in the laughter. Slipping his arm out of his sleeve, Tadatoshi became serious and asked, "Did you come to discuss something?" After going over a number of routine matters, Sado said, "Kakube says he has a samurai to recommend to you." For a moment, there was a faraway look in Tadatoshi's eyes.
"I suppose he's talking about Sasaki Kojiro. He's been mentioned several times. Why don't you call him in and have a look at him? Is he really good? Shouldn't you see for yourself?"
Tadatoshi put on his glove and accepted an arrow from an attendant.
"I'll take a look at Kakube's man," he said. "I'd also like to see that Ronin you mentioned, Miyamoto Musashi, was it? Oh, you remember?"
"I do."
"You're the one who seems to have forgotten." "Not at all. But being so busy, I haven't had a chance to go out to Shimosa." "If you think you've found someone, you should take the time. I'm surprised at you, Sado, letting something so important wait until you've got other business to take you out there. It's not like you." "I'm sorry. There's always too many men looking for positions. I thought you'd forgotten about it. I suppose I should have brought it up again."
"Indeed, you should have. I don't necessarily accept other people's recommendations, but I'm eager to see anyone old Sado considers suitable. Understand?"
Sado apologized again before taking his leave. He went directly to his own house and without further ado had a fresh horse saddled and set out for Hotengahara.
"Isn't this Hotengahara?"
Sato Genzo, Sado's attendant, said,
"That's what I thought, but this is no wilderness. There are rice fields all over. The place they were trying to develop must be nearer the mountains."
They had already gone a good distance beyond the Tokuganji and would soon be on the high road to Hitachi. It was late afternoon, and the white herons splashing about in the paddies made the water seem like powder. Along the riverbank and in the shadows of hillocks grew patches of hemp and waving stalks of barley.
"Look over there, sir," said Genzo.
"What is it?"
"There's a group of farmers."
"So there is. They seem to be bowing to the ground one by one, don't they?"
"It looks like some sort of religious ceremony."
With a snap of the reins, Genzo forded the river first, making sure it was safe for Sado to follow.
"You there!" called Genzo.
The farmers, looking surprised, spread out from their circle to face the visitors. They were standing in front of a small cabin, and Sado could see that the object they'd been bowing before was a tiny wooden shrine, no larger than a birdcage. There were about 50 of them, on their way home from work, it appeared, for their tools had all been washed. A priest came forward, saying,
"Why? It's Nagaoka Sado, isn't it? What a pleasant surprise!"
"And you're from the Tokuganji, aren't you? I believe you're the one who guided me to the village after the bandit raid."
"That's right. Have you come to pay a call at the temple?"
"No, not this time. I'll be going back right away. Could you tell me where I might find that ronin named Miyamoto Musashi?"
"He's not here anymore. He left very suddenly."
"Left suddenly? Why should he do that?"
"One day last month, the villagers decided to take a day off and celebrate the progress that's been made here. You can see for yourself how green it is now. Well, the morning after that, Musashi and the boy, Iori, were gone."
The priest looked around, as though half expecting Musashi to materialize out of the air. In response to Sado's prompting, the priest filled in the details of his story. After the village had strengthened its defenses under Musashi's leadership, the farmers were so thankful for the prospect of living in peace that they practically deified him. Even the ones who had ridiculed him most cruelly had come forward to help with the development project. Musashi treated them all fairly and equally, first convincing them that it was pointless to live like animals. He then tried to impress upon them the importance of exerting a little extra effort so as to give their children a chance for a better life. To be real human beings, he told them, they must work for the sake of posterity. With 40 or 50 villagers pitching in to help each day, by fall they were able to keep the floodwaters under control. When winter came, they plowed, and in the spring, they drew water from the new irrigation ditches and transplanted the rice seedlings. By early summer, the rice was thriving, while in the dry fields, hemp and barley were already a foot high. In another year, the crop would double. The year after that, triple. Villagers began to drop in at the cabin to pay their respects, thanking Musashi from the bottom of their hearts, the women bearing gifts of vegetables. On the day of the celebration, the men arrived with great jars of sake, and all took part in performing a sacred dance, accompanied by drums and flutes. With the villagers gathered around him, Musashi had assured them that it was not his strength, but theirs. "All I did was show you how to use the energy you possess." Then he had taken the priest aside to tell him that he was concerned about their relying on a vagabond like him. "Even without me," he said, "they should have the confidence in themselves and maintain solidarity." He had then taken out a statue of Kannon he'd carved and given it to the priest. The morning after the celebration, the village was in an uproar.
"He's gone! He can't be!"
"Yes, he's disappeared. The cabin's empty."
Grief-stricken, none of the farmers went near the fields that day. When he heard about it, the priest reproached them sharply for their ingratitude, urging them to remember what they'd been taught and subtly coaxing them to carry on the work that had been started. Later, the villagers had built a tiny shrine and placed the treasured image of Kannon in it. They paid their respects to Musashi morning and evening on their way to and from the fields. Sado thanked the priest for the information, concealing the fact that he was disconsolate as only a man of his position could do. As his horse made its way back through the evening mist of late spring, he thought uneasily,
"I shouldn't have put off coming. I was derelict in my duty, and now I've failed my lord."
The Flies. On the east bank of the Sumida River, where the road from Shimosa converged with a branch of the Oshu High Road, rose a great barrier with an imposing gate, ample evidence of the firm rule of Aoyama Tadanari, the new magistrate of Edo. Musashi stood in line, idly waiting his turn, Iori at his side. When he had passed through Edo 3 years earlier, entering and leaving the city had been a simple matter. Even at this distance, he could see that there were far more houses than before, fewer open spaces.
"You there, Ronin, you're next."
Two officials in leather hakama began frisking Musashi with great thoroughness, while a third glared at him and asked questions.
"What business do you have in the capital?"
"Nothing specific."
"No special business, eh?"
"Well, I'm a shugyosha. I suppose it could be said that studying to be a samurai is my business."
The man was silent. Musashi grinned.
"Where were you born?"
"In the village of Miyamoto, district of Yoshino, Mimasaka Province."
"Your master?"
"I have none."
"Who furnishes your travel money?"
"No one. I carve statues and draw pictures. Sometimes I can exchange them for food and lodging. Often I stay at temples. Occasionally I give lessons in the sword. One way or another, I manage."
"Where are you coming from?"
"For the past 2 years, I've been farming in Hotengahara in Shimosa. I decided I didn't want to do that for the rest of my life, so I've come here."
"Do you have a place to stay in Edo? No one can enter the city unless he has relatives or a place to live."
"Yes," replied Musashi on the spur of the moment. He saw that if he tried to stick to the truth, there was going to be no end to it.
"Well? Yagyu Munenori, Lord of Tajima."
The official's mouth dropped open. Musashi, amused at the man's reaction, congratulated himself. The risk of being caught in a lie did not trouble him greatly. He felt that the Yagyus must have heard about him from Takuan. It seemed unlikely they would deny all acquaintance with him if questioned. It might even be that Takuan was in Edo now. If so, Musashi had his means of introduction. It was too late to have a bout with Sekishusai, but he longed to have one with Munenori, his father's successor in the Yagyu style and a personal tutor of the shogun. The name acted like magic.
"Well, well," said the official amiably, "if you're connected with the house of Yagyu, I'm sorry to have troubled you. As you must realize, there are all sorts of samurai on the road. We have to be particularly careful about anyone who appears to be a ronin. Orders, you know."
After a few more questions for the sake of form or face, he said,
"You can go now,"
and personally escorted Musashi to the gate.
"Sir?"
Iori asked when they were on the other side.
"Why are they so careful about ronin and nobody else?"
"They're on the lookout for enemy spies."
"What spy would be stupid enough to come here looking like a ronin? The officials are pretty dumb. Them and their stupid questions. They made us miss the ferry."
"Shh, they'll hear you. Don't worry about the ferry. You can look at Mount Fuji while we're waiting for the next one. Did you know you could see it from here?"
"So what? We could see it from Hotengahara too."
"Yes, but it's different here."
"How?"
"Fuji's never the same. It varies from day to day, hour to hour."
"Looks the same to me."
"It's not, though. It changes. Time, weather, season, the place you're looking at it from. It differs, too, according to the person who's looking at it, according to his heart."
Unimpressed, Iori picked up a flat stone and sent it skimming across the water. After amusing himself in this fashion for a few minutes, he came back to Musashi and asked,
"Are we really going to Lord Yagyu's house?"
"I'll have to think about that."
"Isn't that what you told the guard?"
"Yes, I intended to go, but it's not all that simple. He's a daimyo, you know."
"He must be awfully important. That's what I want to be when I grow up."
"Important?"
"Mm-hmm."
"You shouldn't aim so low."
"What do you mean?"
"Look at Mount Fuji."
"I'll never be like Mount Fuji."
Instead of wanting to be like this or that, make yourself into a silent, immovable giant. That's what the mountain is. Don't waste your time trying to impress people. If you become the sort of man people can respect, they'll respect you, without your doing anything.
Musashi's words didn't have time to sink in, for just then Iori shouted, "Look, here comes the ferry!" and ran ahead to be the first one on board. The Sumida River was a study in contrasts, wide in places, narrow in others, shallow here and deep there. At high tide, the waves washing the banks took on a muddy hue. Sometimes the estuary swelled to twice its normal width. At the point where the ferry crossed, it was virtually an inlet of the bay. The sky was clear, the water transparent. Looking over the side, Iori could see schools of countless tiny fish racing about. Among the rocks, he also spotted the rusty remains of an old helmet. He had no ears for the conversation going on around him.
"What do you think? Is it going to stay peaceful the way it is now?"
"I doubt it."
"You're probably right. Sooner or later, they'll be fighting. I hope not, but what else can you expect?"
Other passengers kept their thoughts to themselves and stared dourly at the water, afraid an official, possibly in disguise, might overhear and connect them with the speakers. Those who did take the risk seemed to enjoy flirting with the ubiquitous eyes and ears of the law.
"You can tell from the way they're checking everybody that we're heading for war. It's only very recently they've been clamping down like that, and there are a lot of rumors about spies from Osaka."
"You also hear about burglars breaking into daimyo's houses, though they try to hush it up. It must be embarrassing being robbed when you're supposed to be the enforcers of law and order.
You'd have to be after more than money to take that kind of risk. It's got to be spies. No ordinary crook would have the nerve."
As he looked around, it occurred to Musashi that the ferry was transporting a fair cross-section of Edo society. A lumberman with sawdust clinging to his work clothes. A couple of cheap geisha who might have come from Kyoto. A broad-shouldered roughneck or two. A group of well-diggers. Two openly coquettish whores. A priest, a beggar monk, another ronin like himself. When the boat reached the Edo side and they all piled out, a short, heavy-set man called to Musashi.
"Hey, you! The ronin! You forgot something!"
He held out a reddish brocade pouch, so old that the dirt seemed to shine more brightly than the few gold threads left in it. Musashi, shaking his head, said,
"It's not mine. It must belong to one of the other passengers."
Iori piped up, "It's mine!" Snatched the pouch from the man's hand and stuffed it into his kimono. The man was indignant.
"What are you doing, grabbing like that? Give it here! Then you're going to bow three times before you get it back. If you don't, you're going to get thrown in the river."
Musashi intervened, asking the man to excuse Iori's rudeness because of his age.
"What are you?"
the man asked roughly.
"Brother? Master? What's your name?"
"Miyamoto Musashi."
"What?"
exclaimed the ruffian, staring hard at Musashi's face. After a moment, he said to Iori,
"You'd better be careful from now on."
Then, as though eager to escape, he turned away.
"Just a moment," said Musashi.
The gentleness of his tone took the man completely by surprise. He whirled around, his hand going to his sword.
"What do you want?"
"What's your name?"
"What's it to you?"
"You asked mine. As a matter of courtesy, you should tell me yours."
"I'm one of Hangawara's men. My name's Juro."
"All right. You can go," said Musashi, pushing him away.
"I won't forget that!"
Juro stumbled a few steps before he found his feet and fled.
"Serves him right, the coward," said Iori.
Satisfied that he'd been vindicated, he looked up worshipfully at Musashi's face and moved closer to him. As they walked into the city, Musashi said,
"Iori, you have to realize that living here is not like being out in the country.
There, we had only foxes and squirrels for neighbors. Here, there are lots of people. You'll have to be more careful about your manners.
Yes, sir.
When people live together in harmony, the earth is a paradise, Musashi went on gravely. But every man has a bad side as well as a good side. There are times when only the bad comes out. Then the world's not paradise, but hell. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yes, I think so, said Iori, more subdued now.
There's a reason we have manners and etiquette. They keep us from letting the bad side take over. This promotes social order, which is the objective of the government's laws. Musashi paused. The way you acted, it was a trivial matter, but your attitude couldn't help but make the man angry. I'm not at all happy about it.
Yes, sir.
I don't know where we'll be going from here, but wherever we are, you'd better follow the rules and act courteously. The boy bobbed his head a couple of times and made a small, stiff bow. They walked on in silence for a short while.
Sir, would you carry my pouch for me? I don't want to lose it again.
Accepting the small brocade bag, Musashi inspected it closely before tucking it into his kimono. Is this the one your father left you?
Yes, sir. I got it back from the Tokuganji at the beginning of the year. The priest didn't take any of the money. You can use some of it if you need to.
Thanks, Musashi said lightly. I'll take good care of it. He has a talent I don't have, mused Musashi, thinking ruefully of his own indifference to personal matters. The boy's innate prudence had taught Musashi the meaning of economics. He appreciated the boy's trust and was growing fonder of him by the day. He looked forward with enthusiasm to the task of helping him develop his native intelligence. Where would you like to stay tonight? He asked. Iori, who had been looking at his new surroundings with great curiosity, remarked,
I see lots of horses over there. It looks like a marketplace right here in town.
He spoke as though he had run across a long-lost friend in a strange country. They had reached Bakurocho, where there was a large and diverse selection of tea shops and hostelries catering to the equine professions— sellers, buyers, draymen, grooms, a variety of lesser factotums. Men in small groups haggled and babbled in a welter of dialects, the most prominent being the tangy, irate-sounding speech of Edo. Among the rabble was a well-groomed samurai searching for good horses. With a disgruntled look, he said, "Let's go home. There's nothing here but nags, nothing worth recommending to his lordship." Striding briskly between the animals, he came face to face with Musashi, blinked, and stepped back in surprise.
You're Miyamoto Musashi, aren't you?
Musashi looked at the man for an instant, then broke into a grin. It was Kimura Sukekuro. Although the two men had come within inches of locking swords at Koyagyu Castle, Sukekuro's manner was cordial. He seemed to bear no lingering rancor from that encounter.
I certainly didn't expect to see you here, he said. Have you been in Edo long?
I've just come from Shimosa, replied Musashi. How's your master? Is he still in good health?
Yes, thank you. But of course, at Sekishusai's age, I'm staying with Lord Munenori. You must come to visit. I'd be glad to introduce you. Oh, there's something else, too.
He flashed a meaningful look and smiled.
We have a beautiful treasure that belongs to you. You must come as soon as you can.
Before Musashi could inquire what the beautiful treasure might be, Sukekuro made a slight bow and walked rapidly away, his attendant trailing along behind. The guests staying at the inexpensive inns of Bakurocho were mostly horse traders in from the provinces. Musashi decided to take a room there rather than in another part of town, where the rates would most likely be higher. Like the other inns, the one he chose had a large stable, so large, in fact, that the rooms themselves seemed rather like an annex. But after the rigors of Hotengahara, even this third-rate hostelry seemed luxurious. Despite his feeling of well-being, Musashi found the horseflies annoying and began grumbling. The proprietress heard him.
"I'll change your room," she offered solicitously. "The flies aren't so bad on the second floor."
Once resettled, Musashi found himself exposed to the full strength of the western sun and felt like grumbling again. Only a few days ago, the afternoon sun would have been a source of cheer, a bright ray of hope shedding nourishing warmth on the rice plants and portending good weather for the morrow. As for the flies, when his sweat had attracted them while he worked in the fields, he had taken the view that they were only going about their chores, just as he was going about his. He had even regarded them as fellow creatures. Now, having crossed one wide river and entered the maze of the city, he found the heat of the sun anything but comforting, the flies only an irritation. His appetite took his mind off the inconveniences. He glanced at Iori and saw symptoms of lassitude and gluttony in his face, too. Small wonder, for a party in the next room had ordered a great pot of steaming food and was now attacking it ravenously, amid much talk, laughter, and drinking. Buckwheat noodles, soba, that's what he wanted. In the country, if a man wanted soba, he planted buckwheat in the early spring, watched it flower in the summer, dried the grain in the fall, ground the flour in the winter. Then he could make soba. Here, it required no more effort than clapping one's hands for service. "Yuri, shall we order some soba?"
"Yes," came the eager reply.
The proprietress came and took their order. While they waited, Musashi propped his elbows on the windowsill and shaded his eyes. Diagonally across the way was a signboard reading, "Souls Polished Here, Zushino Kosuke, Master in the Honami Style." Iori had noticed it too. After staring for a moment in bewilderment, he said,
"That sign says Souls Polished. What sort of business is that?"
"Well, it also says the man works in the Honami style, so I suppose he's a sword polisher. Come to think of it, I ought to have my sword worked on." The soba was slow to arrive, so Musashi stretched out on the tatami for a nap. But the voices in the next room had risen several decibels and become quarrelsome. "Yori," he said, opening one eye, "will you ask the people next door to be a little quieter?" Only Shoji separated the two rooms, but instead of opening them, Iori went out into the hall. The door to the other room was open.
"Don't make so much noise," he shouted. "My teacher's trying to sleep."
"Huh?" The squabble came to an abrupt halt. The men turned and stared angrily at him.
"You say something, shrimp?"
Pouting at the epithet, Iori said,
"We came upstairs because of the flies. Now you're yelling so much he can't rest."
"Is this your idea, or did your master send you?"
"He sent me."
"Did he? Well, I'm not wasting my time talking to a little turd like you. Go tell your master Kumagoro of Chichibu. We'll give him his answer later. Now beat it!"
Kumagoro was a great brute of a man, and the two or three others in the room were not much smaller. Cowed by the menace in their eyes, Iori quickly retreated. Musashi had dropped off to sleep. Not wanting to disturb him, Iori sat down by the window. Presently, one of the horse traders opened the shoji a crack and peeked in at Musashi. There followed much laughter, accompanied by loud and insulting remarks.
"Who does he think he is, butting into our party? Dumb loaning? No telling where he comes from, just barges in and starts acting like he owns the place. We'll have to show him what's what."
"Yeah, we'll make sure he knows what the horse traders of Edo are made of."
Talking's not going to show him. Let's haul him out back and throw a bucket of horse piss in his face.
Kumagoro spoke up.
Hold on now. Let me handle this. Either I'll get an apology in writing, or we'll wash his face with horse piss. Enjoy your sake. Leave everything to me.
This should be good,
said one man, as Kumagoro, with a confident smirk, tightened his obi.
I beg your pardon,
said Kumagoro, sliding the shoji open. Without standing up, he shuffled into Musashi's room on his knees. The soba, 6 helpings and a lacquered box, had finally arrived. Musashi was sitting up now, addressing his chopsticks to his first helping.
Look, they're coming in,
said Iori under his breath, moving slightly to get out of the way. Kumagoro seated himself behind and to Iori's left, legs crossed, elbows resting on his knees. With a fierce scowl, he said,
You can eat later. Don't try to hide the fact that you're scared by sitting there playing with your food.
Though he was grinning, Musashi gave no indication that he was listening. He stirred the soba with his chopsticks to separate the strands, lifted a mouthful, and swallowed with a joyous slurp. The veins in Kumagoro's forehead nearly popped.
Put that bowl down, he said angrily.
And who are you? Musashi asked mildly, making no move to comply.
You don't know who I am? The only people in Bakurojo who haven't heard my name are good-for-nothings and deaf-mutes.
I'm a little hard of hearing myself. Speak up. Tell me who you are and where you come from.
I'm Kumagoro from Chichibu, the best horse trader in Edo. When children see me coming, they get so scared they can't even cry.
I see. Then you're in the horse business?
You bet I am. I sell to the samurai. You'd better remember that when you're dealing with me.
In what way am I dealing with you?
You sent that runt there to complain about the noise. Where do you think you are? This is no fancy inn for daimyo, nice and quiet and all. We horse traders like noise.
I gathered that.
Then why were you trying to bust up our party? I demand an apology.
Apology?
Yes, in writing. You can address it to Kumagoro and his friends. If we don't get one, we'll take you outside and teach you a thing or two.
What you say is interesting.
Huh?
I mean, your way of speaking is interesting.
Cut out the nonsense! Do we get the apology or don't we? Well?
Kumagoro's voice had gone from a growl to a roar, and the sweat on his crimson forehead glistened in the evening sun. Looking ready to explode, he bared his hairy chest and took a dagger from his stomach wrapper.
Make up your mind! If I don't hear your answer soon, you're in big trouble!
He uncrossed his legs and held the dagger vertically beside the lacquer box, its point touching the floor. Musashi, restraining his mirth, said,
Well, now, how should I respond to that?
Lowering his bowl, he reached out with his chopsticks, removed the dark speck from the soba in the box, and threw it out the window. Still silent, he reached out again and picked off another dark speck, then another. Kumagoro's eyes bugged. His breath halted.
There's no end to them, is there? Remarked Musashi casually. Here, Iori, go give these chopsticks a good washing.
As Iori went out, Kumagoro faded silently back into his own room and in a hushed voice told his companions of the incredible sight he had just witnessed. After first mistaking the black spots on the soba for dirt, he had realized they were live flies, plucked so deftly they had no time to escape. Within minutes, he and his fellows transferred their little party to a more remote quarter, and silence reigned.
That's better, isn't it? Said Musashi to Iori.
The two of them grinned at one another. By the time they'd finished their meal, the sun was down,
and the moon was shining wanly above the roof of the sole polisher's shop. Musashi stood up and straightened his kimono. "I think I'll see about having my sword taken care of," he said. He picked up the weapon and was about to leave when the proprietress came halfway up the blackened staircase and called, "A letter's come for you." Puzzled that anyone should know his whereabouts so soon, Musashi went down, accepted the missive, and asked, "Is the messenger still here?"
"No, he left immediately."
The outside of the letter bore only the word "Suke," which Musashi took to stand for Kimura Sukekuro. Unfolding it, he read, "I informed Lord Munenori that I saw you this morning. He seemed happy to receive word of you after all this time. He instructed me to write and ask when you will be able to visit us." Musashi descended the remaining steps and went to the office, where he borrowed ink and brush. Seating himself in a corner, he wrote on the back of Sukekuro's letter, "I shall be happy to visit Lord Munenori whenever he wishes to have a bout with me. As a warrior, I have no other purpose in calling on him." He signed the note Masana, a formal name he seldom used. "Iori," he called from the bottom of the stairs, "I want you to run an errand for me."
"Yes, sir."
"I want you to deliver a letter to Lord Yagyu Munenori."
"Yes, sir."
According to the proprietress, everybody knew where Lord Munenori lived, but she offered directions anyway.
"Go down the main street until you come to the high road. Go straight along that as far as Nihonbashi. Then bear to the left and go along the river until you get to Kobikicho. That's where it is. You can't miss it."
"Thanks," said Iori, who already had his sandals on.
"I'm sure I can find it."
He was delighted at the opportunity to go out, particularly since his destination was the home of an important daimyo. Giving no thought to the hour, he walked away quickly, swinging his arms and holding his head up proudly. As Musashi watched him turn the corner, he thought, "He's a little too self-confident for his own good." The Sole Polisher. "Good evening," called Musashi. Nothing about Zushino Kosuke's house suggested it was a place of business. It lacked the grilled front of most shops, and there was no merchandise on display. Musashi stood in the dirt-floored passageway running down the left side of the house. To his right was a raised section, floored with tatami and screened off from the room beyond it. The man sleeping on the tatami with his arms resting on a strong box resembled a Taoist sage Musashi had once seen in a painting. The long, thin face was the grayish color of clay. Musashi could detect in it none of the keenness he associated with sword craftsmen.
"Good evening," Musashi repeated a little louder.
When his voice penetrated Kosuke's torpor, the craftsman raised his head very slowly. He might have been awakening from centuries of slumber. Wiping the saliva from his chin and sitting up straight, he asked lackadaisically,
"Can I help you?"
Musashi's impression was that a man like this might make swords, as well as souls, duller. But he nevertheless held out his own weapon and explained why he was there.
"Let me take a look at it."
Kosuke's shoulders perked up smartly. Placing his left hand on his knee, he reached out with his right to take the sword, simultaneously bowing his head toward it. "Strange creature," thought Musashi. "He barely acknowledges the presence of a human being, but bows politely to a sword." Holding a piece of paper in his mouth, Kosuke quietly slid the blade out of the scabbard. He stood it vertically in front of him and examined it from hilt to tip. His eyes took on a bright glitter, reminding Musashi of glass eyes in a wooden Buddhist statue. Snapping the weapon back into its scabbard, Kosuke looked up inquiringly at Musashi.
"Come, have a seat," he said,
moving back to make room and offering Musashi a cushion.
Musashi removed his sandals and stepped up into the room.
Has the sword been in your family for some generations?
Oh, no, said Musashi. It's not the work of a famous swordsmith, nothing like that.
Have you used it in battle, or do you carry it for the usual purposes?
I haven't used it on the battlefield. There's nothing special about it. The best you could say is that it's better than nothing.
Looking
directly into Musashi's eyes, Kosuke then asked,
How do you want it polished?
How do I want it polished? What do you mean?
Do you want it sharpened so it'll cut well?
Well, it is a sword. The cleaner it cuts, the better.
I suppose so, agreed Kosuke with a defeated sigh.
What's wrong with that? Isn't it the business of a craftsman to sharpen swords so they'll cut properly?
As Musashi spoke, he squinted curiously into Kosuke's face.
The self-proclaimed polisher of souls shoved the weapon toward Musashi and said,
I can't do anything for you. Take it to somebody else.
Strange indeed, thought Musashi.
He could not disguise a certain vexation, but he said nothing. Kosuke, his lips tightly set, made no attempt to explain. While they sat silently staring at each other, a man from the neighborhood stuck his head in the door.
Kosuke, have you got a fishing pole? It's high tide and the fish are jumping. If you'll lend me a pole, I'll divide my catch with you.
Kosuke plainly regarded the man as one more burden he ought not to have to bear.
Borrow one somewhere else, he rasped. I don't believe in killing, and I don't keep instruments for murder in my house.
The man went quickly away, leaving Kosuke looking grumpier than ever. Another man might have become discouraged and left, but Musashi's curiosity held him there. There was something appealing about this man, not wit nor intelligence, but a rough natural goodness, like that of a karatsu sake jar or a tea bowl by Nonko. Just as pottery often has a blemish evocative of its closeness to the earth, Kosuke had, in a semi-bald spot on his temple, a lesion of some sort, which he'd covered with salve. While attempting to conceal his growing fascination, Musashi said,
What is there to keep you from polishing my sword? Is it of such poor quality you can't put a good edge on it? Of course not. You're the owner. You know as well as I do, it's a perfectly good Bizen sword. I also know you want it sharpened for the purpose of cutting people.
Is there anything wrong with that?
That's what they all say. What's wrong with wanting me to fix a sword so it'll cut better? If the sword cuts, they're happy.
But a man bringing in a sword to be polished naturally wants...
Just a minute. Kosuke raised his hand. It'll take some time to explain. First, I'd like you to take another look at the sign on the front of my shop.
It says, Souls Polished, or at least I think so. Is there any other way of reading the characters?
No. You'll notice it doesn't say a word about polishing swords. My business is polishing the souls of the samurai who come in, not their weapons. People don't understand, but that's what I was taught when I studied sword polishing.
I see, said Musashi, although he didn't really.
Since I try to abide by my master's teachings, I refuse to polish the swords of samurai who take pleasure in killing people.
Well, you have a point there. But tell me, who was this master of yours?
That's written on the sign, too. I studied in the house of Honwami, under Honwami Koetsu himself.
Kosuke squared his shoulders proudly as he uttered his master's name. That's interesting. I happen to have made the acquaintance of your master and his excellent mother, Myoshu. Musashi went on to tell how he had met them in the field near the Rendaiji and later spent a few days at their house. Kosuke, astonished, scrutinized him closely for a moment.
"Are you by any chance the man who caused a great stir in Kyoto some years ago by defeating the Yoshioka school at Ichijoji? Miyamoto Musashi was the name, I believe."
"That is my name." Musashi's face reddened slightly. Kosuke moved back a bit and bowed deferentially, saying,
"Forgive me. I shouldn't have been lecturing you. I had no idea I was talking to the famous Miyamoto Musashi."
"Don't give it a second thought. Your words were very instructive. Koetsu's character comes through in the lessons he teaches his disciples.
As I'm sure you know, the Hoami family served the Ashikaga shoguns. From time to time, they've also been called upon to polish the emperor's swords. Koetsu was always saying that Japanese swords were created not to kill or injure people, but to maintain the imperial rule and protect the nation, to subdue devils and drive out evil. The sword is the samurai's soul. He carries it for no other purpose than to maintain his own integrity. It is an ever-present admonition to the man who rules over other men and seeks, in doing so, to follow the way of life. It's only natural that the craftsman who polishes the sword must also polish the swordsman's spirit."
"How true," agreed Musashi.
"Koetsu said that to see a good sword is to see the sacred light, the spirit of the nation's peace and tranquility. He hated touching a bad sword. Even being near one used to nauseate him."
"I see. Are you saying you sensed something evil in my sword?"
"No, not in the least. I just felt a little depressed. Since coming to Edo, I've worked on any number of weapons, but none of their owners seem to have an inkling of the sword's true meaning. I sometimes doubt they have souls to polish. All they care about is quartering a man or splitting his head open, helmet and all. It got so tiresome. That's why I put up a new sign a few days ago. It doesn't seem to have had much effect, though."
"And I came in asking for the same thing, didn't I? I understand how you feel."
"Well, that's a beginning. Things may turn out a little differently with you. But frankly, when I saw that blade of yours, I was shocked. All those nicks and stains, stains made by human flesh. I thought you were just one more senseless ronin, proud of himself for committing a number of meaningless murders."
Musashi bowed his head. It was the voice of Koetsu, coming from Kosuke's mouth. "I'm grateful for this lesson," he said. "I've carried a sword since I was a boy, but I've never really given sufficient thought to the spirit that resides in it. In the future, I'll pay heed to what you've said."
Kosuke appeared vastly relieved. "In that case, I'll polish the sword for you. Or perhaps I should say I consider it a privilege for one in my profession to be able to polish the soul of a samurai like yourself."
Twilight had faded, and the lights had been lit. Musashi decided it was time to go.
"Wait," said Kosuke. "Do you have another sword to carry while I'm working on this one?"
"No, I have only the one long sword."
"In that case, why don't you pick out a replacement? None of the swords I have here now are very good, I'm afraid, but come and take a look."
He guided Musashi into the back room, where he took several swords out of a cabinet and lined them up on the tatami.
"You can take any one of these," he offered.
Despite the craftsman's modest disavowal, they were all weapons of excellent quality. Musashi had difficulty choosing from the dazzling display, but finally he selected one and immediately fell in love with it. Just holding it in his hands, he sensed its maker's dedication. Drawing the blade from the scabbard confirmed his impression. It was indeed a beautiful piece of workmanship, probably dating from the Yoshino period in the 14th century. Nagged by the doubt that it was too elegant for him, once he had brought it close to the light and examined it, he found his hands reluctant to let it go.
"May I take this one?" he asked.
He could not bring himself to use the word borrow.
"You have the eye of an expert," observed Kosuke, as he put away the other swords.
For once in his life, Musashi was swamped by covetousness. He knew it was futile to mention buying the sword outright. The price would be far beyond his means. But he couldn't help himself.
"I don't suppose you'd consider selling me the sword, would you?" he asked.
"Why not?"
"How much are you asking for it?"
"I'll let you have it for what I paid for it."
"How much was that?"
20 pieces of gold." An almost inconceivable sum to Musashi.
"I'd better give it back," he said hesitantly.
"Why?" asked Kosuke with a puzzled look. "I'll lend it to you for as long as you wish. Go on, take it."
"No, that'll make me feel even worse. Wanting it the way I do is bad enough. If I wore it for a while, it would be torture to part with it."
"Are you really so attached to it?" Kosuke looked at the sword, then at Musashi. "All right, then. I'll give it to you. In wedlock, as it were. But I expect an appropriate gift in exchange."
Musashi was baffled.
He had absolutely nothing to offer.
"I heard from Koetsu that you carve statues. I'd be honored if you'd make me an image of Kannon. That would be sufficient payment."
The last Kannon Musashi had carved was the one he'd left in Hotengahara.
"I have nothing on hand," he said, "but in the next few days I can carve something for you. May I have the sword then?"
"Certainly. I didn't mean to imply I expected it this minute. By the way, instead of putting up at that inn, why don't you come and stay with us? We have a room we're not using."
"That would be perfect," said Musashi. "If I moved in tomorrow, I could start on the statue right away."
"Come and take a look at it," urged Kosuke, who was also happy and excited. Musashi followed him down the outside passageway, at the end of which was a flight of half a dozen steps. Tucked in between the first and second floors, not quite belonging to either, was an 8-mat room. Through the window, Musashi could see the dew-laden leaves of an apricot tree. Pointing at a roof covered with oyster shells, Kosuke said,
"That's my workshop there."
The craftsman's wife, as if summoned by a secret signal, arrived with sake and some tidbits. When the two men sat down, the distinction between host and guest seemed to evaporate. They relaxed, legs stretched out, and opened their hearts to each other, oblivious of the restraints normally imposed by etiquette. The talk, of course, turned to their favorite subject.
"Everybody pays lip service to the importance of the sword," said Kosuke. "Anybody'll tell you the sword's the soul of the samurai, and that a sword is one of the country's 3 sacred treasures. But the way people actually treat swords is scandalous, and I include samurai and priests as well as townsmen. I took it upon myself at one time to go around to shrines and old houses where there were once whole collections of beautiful swords, and I can tell you the situation is shocking."
Kosuke's pale cheeks were ruddy now. His eyes burned with enthusiasm, and the saliva that gathered at the corners of his mouth occasionally flew in a spray right into his companion's face.
"Almost none of the famous swords from the past are being properly taken care of.
At Sua Shrine in Shinano Province, there are more than 300 swords. They could be classed as heirlooms, but I found only 5 that weren't rusted. Omishima Shrine in Iyo is famous for its collection, 3,000 swords dating